Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with Roseanne Montillo, an accomplished research librarian who earned her MFA from Emerson College and has taught creative writing at Emerson and the Tufts Extension School. Her new book is Deliberate Cruelty. She has also published four previous works of narrative nonfiction to critical acclaim: Fire on the Track, The Wilderness of Ruin, Atomic Women, and The Lady and Her Monsters. Here's some information about Deliberate Cruelty. When Anne Woodward shot her husband, banking heir Billy Woodward, in the middle of the night in 1955, her life changed forever. Though she claimed she thought he was a prowler, few believed the woman who had risen from charismatic showgirl to popular socialite. Everyone had something to say about the scorching scandal afflicting one of the most rich and famous families of New York City. But no one was more obsessed with the tale than Truman Capote. Acclaimed for his best-selling nonfiction book, In Cold Blood, Capote was looking for new material and followed the scandal from beginning to end. Like Anne, he too had ascended from nobody to toast of the town, but he always felt like an outsider, even among the exclusive coterie of high society women who adored him. He decided the story of Anne's turbulent marriage would be the basis of his masterpiece, a novel about the dysfunction and sordid secrets revealed to him by his high society swans, never thinking that it would eventually lead to Anne's suicide and his own scandalous downfall. So I have Roseanne on the line now. Welcome to Write the Book. It's really nice to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I wanted to start by asking you to talk a little bit about the story of Anne Woodward, who was accused of murdering her husband, a tragedy which was ultimately judged to have been an accident. You also remind us about Truman Capote's unkind fascination with her. So I'm wondering if we can start by just going over the crime of which she was accused.
Right. She was accused of killing her husband during the night, Halloween weekend, 1955. And it was not their primary residence. And when they went there, they used to go in their home in Oyster Bay for the weekend. They used to spend a little bit of time away from the city just to get away and be with their family, because they were having a little bit of anxiety in their marriage, a little bit of a few issues here and there. And they thought that perhaps being away from home, from their main residence in New York, will bring them closer together. And the reality was that nothing would really work out. Not being away, not being on vacation, not being together for a long time or apart for a very long time. The marriage was pretty much in shambles, and they were going to be divorced eventually. When they got there, they found out that a prowler was going on in their city. He was a young man of international origins, who was really not that great of a prowler, so to speak. He left little clues here and there that he had been around. And of course, you know, these being very wealthy individuals, they immediately became, not that those who weren't wealthy weren't going to be afraid, but somehow, for some reason, these people, all of them, those who were having the young man in their homes, became very afraid. They didn't really like the idea that someone was going around their homes, touching their things, sleeping in their beds when they were not around, just being, you know, in their homes, in their closets, playing around with their very expensive toys, so to speak.
Right.
And so they had come up with a little bit of a trap to kind of con him into being there and being able to catch him if he was going to be there. And Woodward believed as much as her husband did, that the prowler not only had been there before, but that weekend somehow he was going to make it to their home. They were convinced that their home was going to be next on the list. And that's why both of them, who did not share a bedroom, went to bed with a gun in their bedroom.
Okay, all right.
So whether it was an excuse or not, it was rather convenient that both of them had a gun next to their nightstand, so to speak. It's not the usual thing that people bring to bed.
No, no. So why did Truman Capote care at all about Ann Woodward? He was obsessed with this case and also had a sort of a little bit of a personal vendetta against her, it sounded like.
He did. I mean, the life of the rich had always fascinated him.
Right.
He enjoyed blending with them. He enjoyed being around them. There was something about the very wealthy that fascinated him from the very beginning, from the very early start in New York. He enjoyed being sort of in their periphery. He enjoyed being around them. I don't know if he felt like he didn't belong. And in a sense, once he became very, very famous, it was sort of, now here I am. I'm part of your commune, so to speak. But something about Ann Woodward made him uncomfortable. Of course, they had a small argument. It wasn't really an argument once they got to Europe. She called him a very demeaning name. She was very offensive. And he replied in kind. So, but it wasn't enough to really... it wasn't enough to give him that sort of animosity, to explain that animosity towards him, towards her. I always believed that there was something about her that said more about him. She was a small town girl who had made it very big in New York. She came from a broken family. Her mother was a poor woman who tried very hard to make money. She had married several times. She had had children out of wedlock. So in many ways, she reminded him of his own mother, who was not any better. So their backgrounds, when you take them together, do resemble quite a bit. So I always believed there was something about her that really played. One would imagine that the two of them should have been great friends. They could have had great conversations.
Right,
you know, they could have, in another world, perhaps they would have had some recollection, you know, had coffee or drank martinis or something and said, gee, look how far we've come. It wasn't going to be that way.
Yeah, yeah, right. Now, is it true that Billy's father had an affair with Anne before Billy ever asked her out?
He met her at a club where she was dancing. When she came to New York, when she went to New York, she had really big dreams. She wanted to be an actress. She wanted to be a dancer. She was aiming for Hollywood. So New York was sort of a side trip that she took. She felt that if she went to New York first, like her idols, she wouldn't make it big on the stage there. She would make it big maybe as a model, as an actress, or as something, and eventually that would take her to Hollywood. Once she got to New York, she realized that she was one of many, many, many young women who have the same dream. Maybe back in Kansas City, she was one of the few, and maybe she was, you know, she could have been adorable, talented, and beautiful. But in New York, she got lost in the shuffle. And I think the same thing happens today. Perhaps a young woman in a small town can be seen as being extra talented, but once you get into the big city, you realize that you're one of the many. And it becomes much more difficult. She also realized that it was very difficult to make money. So she had to do the kind of dancing that maybe she wasn't prepared for. And that got her in touch with society people, society men. And William Woodward Sr. was one of those people. And he was having a difficult time in his own marriage. He was married to a woman who was very rigid, who was strict, who was not too happy being a mother, mm-hmm. who was not the kindest, perhaps. Well, if not the kindest, who was not the warmest individual. So he liked Anne more than he did his wife. And, that's trying to be kind about it, trying to put it kindly about it.
I would think he was used to getting what he wanted, it sounds like, too.
Well, yeah, he was a very wealthy individual. And Anne was not.
Yeah.
So at the time, money talked.
Yeah. I'm curious about what drew you to the story. I'm also curious if you can talk a little bit about what it is about true crime that fascinates an audience, do you think?
Well, you know, I've always been a fan of Truman Capote.
Oh, okay.
I think, I always thought him a very interesting individual. But I think an awful lot of people know about him through his other work, especially in Cold Blood. When you mention Truman Capote, that book is his big book. And people have come to know him through that particular story, which, you know, is wonderful. And he's, or Breakfast at Tiffany, which are very two different stories.
Sure.
Incredibly different, but very stylized. And In Cold Blood is probably gave birth to the true crime genre, in my opinion. And so when I read a biography about him, and I read a small line about the Woodward murder, I think I was probably one of the many who thought, well, I didn't know about this other crime that he was fascinated. And I also didn't know that he had been in touch with another criminal when he was a younger boy. So there was kind of a, it seemed like he was involved in criminal, he was fascinated by crime from a very young age. In Cold Blood wasn't his only or his first run-of-the-mill crime.
Right.
And I think nowadays people have a certain fascination with true crime because, well, it's everywhere. And I don't mean in the news because you see it in the news, but it's Netflix has given us a chance to watch that. Cable, they have channels running over and over and all kinds of show. The ID channel, I can pinpoint to that. Movies, books. Yeah. There are books being published all the time, and also podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. You podcasts, right. There's so many. Do you still like Truman Capote as much as you did before you started writing this book? Or I'm not sure you said you liked him or if you were fascinated by him, but I'm just curious.
I was fascinated by him. I appreciated his dedication to his work.
Right.
And I still do. On a personal level, I think he was flawed in many, many ways. Do I appreciate what he did? Yes and no. He didn't lie, which I think it's important to remind people of that. He was always telling most people he knew that he was writing a book and that he was going to tell all the secrets that they had told him about, that all the women had told him about. On the one hand, he lied when he said that, you know, he was going to use everything. On the other hand, he lied when he said, you know, I apologize, my dog is going wild.
Is that Trixie?
Yes, it is Trixie.
Is Trixie okay?
She is. She's doing better. Thank you very much.
I should say we had scheduled this interview earlier, and Trixie had a problem we had to reschedule, so that's why we're live today, which
obviously,
is fine.
Obviously, she's doing much better.
I'm glad.
You know, she's patrolling the street, which, you know, is full of dogs. I think many of his friends didn't take him entirely seriously when he said that he was going to use them. For whatever reason, they didn't believe that he was the kind of person who was really going to tell on them.
Yeah.
I think that's where the problem was.
Right.
So
yeah.
Do I still like him? I'm still fascinated by him. I still appreciate his work. Like is a strong word, I think, but I appreciate what he did. I wouldn't have done it. You know, I wouldn't have spilled the beans on everybody. But, you know, people have different reasons for doing what they do.
It was different times, too, right?
It was a different time.
Which isn't to excuse him, but I think that, I don't know why.
Nowadays, people want to have their stories told.
Yes.
They want to have their secrets told.
That's true.
For the likes, I suppose.
I suppose. That's really a good point. I want to just step away from the book for 1 second. You have an MFA from Emerson, and you've also taught there. And I was reading a little bit about that aspect of your life, and you have taught courses on the intersection of literature and history. So this is a little bit of a funny, random question, but what is one thing a student might have learned in that class, the intersection of literature and history?
I think most of my students I've taken some time off, that history is boring. And the literature, especially the older books, is boring as well. You know, they believe that the two cannot go hand in hand. I remember I used to teach courses at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I came up, you know, with a list of really older books like Dante's Inferno or Frankenstein. And they used to tell me, you know, we read these before. What's the point of reading them again? And my point was that they were based in history. They were based in science. They didn't just come out of the blue, even though, you know, most of them believed that they were just they just came out from the author's imagination, but that most of them had a basis in history, in science, in religion, and in the times in which they lived. So all of them were a compilation of not really random thoughts, but everything that was going on around them. Mm-hmm. So if you take everything that was happening around the author's time, you can come up with a beautiful, long-lasting work of art. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that my students took away from the class was to kind of look around themselves and see what is happening, and then see how that can relate to whatever form of art you're working on, mm-hmm. be it literature, film, because Emerson does a little bit of everything, you know, literature, film, television, journalism, and not think of history as a static thing that you have to learn, you know, whatever happened in the 1800s stays there.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's great. That sounds like a great class. Let's see, your own work is more historical, true crime, than historical fiction, as I understand it.
Yes.
Have you ever thought of fictionalizing a story like this one? You mentioned how Capote, you write about how Capote did this very, it sounds like poorly, in Answered Prayers, the book that he never finished about high and low society in New York City. But anyway, did you ever think of fictionalizing one of these stories?
I have. Actually, at the time that I was studying for my MFA, my concentration was fiction.
Okay.
So I do write fiction quite a bit, but I have to be honest with you, once you start researching, and I've done a lot of researching.
I bet.
I worked in libraries. I find myself unable to play around with the facts that I find. I feel like I'm almost being dishonest. So find myself unable to fictionalize everything that I find. So I feel like you have to be true to the details, the people that you learn about, the facts that you learn about. And somehow I wouldn't feel right fictionalizing any of the stories that I, you know, that I learn about, any of the details, any of the clues, anything that's important. For me, a story has to be true, has to be narrated as it comes, has to be perfectly correct, at least to the level that I find.
Okay, great. Can you talk
I don't admire historical fiction writers. I do, and I read about that quite a bit, but, you know, at the moment, it stays nonfiction.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you want to present history in a certain way, and it's not the way that you would have to somewhat play with the facts in order to make it historical fiction, or create dialogue, for example, or create right. what the missing pieces may be. Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Who were Truman Capote's swans? Can you just talk about that for a minute?
Lee Radziwill. She was Jackie Kennedy's sister, and she was a very interesting individual. Truman Capote, I think, liked her more than he liked Jackie. I think he found Lee much more interesting, less rigid, a lot more fun. He liked fun. He liked people who were drinking. He liked people who liked to drink. He liked gossip a lot. He liked people who had a good secret and people who weren't afraid to share with him. Mm-hmm. People who weren't afraid to reveal their feelings for to him. People who weren't afraid to just come to dinner and, tell a good story. And he was a good listener. He was a good listener. And although he didn't take notes right on the spot, the first thing he did when he went home was jot everything down in that little diary of his. And Babe Paley was another one of his swans. She was a very beautiful woman and someone who had a lot to tell him. She became one of his best friends. He knew her for about 20 or 30 years, and he knew everything about her. He knew everything about her marriages, knew everything about the problems in her marriage. He knew everything about her sex life. And that's why when he wrote the story that he did with her as being one of the protagonists, she became so upset about it. She became so angry. And he wasn't even angry that he talked about her. I think her anger was more directed to the fact that they had such an intimate friendship that afterwards she felt like a brother or a companion had really cut her open. She was dying from cancer, and he published that story right when she was dying. So for someone to do that to her at that particular moment, to reveal that her husband was having an affair with someone else, she felt so betrayed after 20 or 30 years, and one can understand that.
The piece that was published was that the excerpt La Cote Basque 1965.
Yes, it was. It was supposed to be the fifth chapter of the book that was never finished, and he decided against his publisher's advice to give it to Esquire magazine. Publish it there. And when it came out, the whole of New York just kind of became embroiled in the whole controversy. Mm-hmm. And, he didn't think very much about it. He didn't think it was anything too... that's what he said. But I think deep down, he was aware that he was going to cause a big controversy. He was aware that people were going to be upset with him. But at the same time, he knew that he was going to sell many copies. So it was, do I want to be an artist and do what I want, or do I want to keep my friends? And are they going to take me back into their circle once again? And he chose to be an artist.
But it hurt him professionally too, didn't it?
It did, very much so, because, he wasn't able to finish that book. He wasn't able to... His professional life was embroiled with his personal life quite a bit. His inspiration came from his personal life. So once his personal life was cut off, he couldn't really write anymore. He hadn't been writing for quite a while. Mm. Anyway, his writing had slowed down after In Cold Blood. And now it was completely gone. What he did was drink a lot. He did drugs quite a bit. He didn't see many friends. He isolated himself. He ran off to California. Then he was back in New York. Then he was back in California once again. So he really didn't do anything besides going to Studio 54 and getting drunk. Mm-hmm. So it was like watching a really slow descent into an artist dying.
Yeah.
So that chapter from that book that never came, it was just the final nail in the coffin for him.
Mm-hmm. Roseanne, I always like to ask my guests if they've read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners. And it doesn't have to be in your own genre. It can be poetry. It can be, children's literature, whatever it is.
I actually just, speaking of classics, I just went back. I read it once a year. And I just went back to my favorite book of Frankenstein.
Okay.
I think it's important to, I started reading it when I was teaching. And I probably have read this 100 times.
Oh my gosh.
I haven't memorized. I wrote a book about Frankenstein and Mary Shelley. And people ask me why I do that. But I think it's important to go back to the classics and find out, well, not only find out, but learn from them. And learn why they've lasted for so long, why they continue to sell, what makes them such a classic.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to learn the techniques, the research, because Mary Shelley, believe it or not, she did quite a lot of research on that. And also, it's important to find out why people continue to read that. I read it at different stages in my life. And what I got from it when I was 18 is very different than what I got from it at 26 and at 30 and at 40 and so on. So why is that? The best books will continue to do that.
And which is the book that you wrote that was about that?
The Lady and Her Monsters.
Oh, okay, sure.
And it's the story behind the story.
Wonderful. Okay, great. What are you writing next? Do you know what your next project is?
No, I've been researching a few things. I'm hoping that I have another tantalizing book under my belt. We'll see. I'm intrigued by the cross-section of literature, true crime, and artistic sort of, I don't want to say debauchery, but, something equally tantalizing that perhaps will give me another look into the lives of the rich and famous and their doings as well. Okay. Or maybe will be something completely different. I don't know. At the moment, I'm enjoying having this book out and speaking to people and seeing if they like it or not.
Oh, I liked it.
Thank you very much.
Let me just ask you my last question. It's sort of my second to last question, but it's my last main question. So I wonder, so there you are. You know the few things that interest you, the intersection of history, of literature, perhaps of something true in crime, maybe a certain time period, I don't know, that you gravitate toward. I wonder if somebody is a writer and they know what they are drawn toward, do you have any advice for finding the right story to tell?
I spend a lot of time in libraries, And what I recommend is to do a lot of research also in newspapers from like the 1800s, 1900s. I look them over, libraries in my area, but also libraries on the computer itself, journals that come from across the country. You'll be surprised what you can find in those old newspapers. They really spark the imagination. I found a couple of my books in little notices in newspapers, and a little notice of a few lines can get you going in many different directions.
Wow.
And Fire on the Track was a small notice in a little newspaper from around here that talked about women at the Olympics.
Oh,
track
wow.
meet at the Olympics. So you will never know. Read about old newspapers from your area and across the country.
Okay, wonderful. So the very last thing I do is I always offer a writing prompt to my listeners who are writers. And I don't know if you have anything to offer. If not, that's fine. I can come up with something at the end of the show. But if you do, I would love to hear it.
One seems very basic. A lot of people say keep a journal.
Uh-huh.
And in that journal, I write a lot of things, that seems pretty mundane, like the things you dream about, the things you eat, and sometimes those will prompt to keep on going and going. But sometimes I write things that are a little bit more detailed, things like, such as arriving at a new B&B, people who live there, imagine the things that the lives of those who live in homes that you just spend a couple of hours in or a couple of days in, or, you know, going back to your old hometown 20, 10, 15, 20 years after you've left it, and imagine a life with your elementary school sweetheart and see how your life would have turned out if things had, if you had stayed behind, or maybe taking up a book that you like. For me, it's Frankenstein. And what would have happened if that book had been told from the point of view of the creature instead of Dr. Frankenstein? Things of that. I used to do prompts with my students almost every day.
Yeah.
And there are an endless variety of them.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Thank you for that. I want to just mention again that the name of your book is Deliberate Cruelty, published by Atria Books. And I've been speaking with Roseanne Montillo, the author of the book. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it and enjoyed it very much.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. You just heard an interview with the author Roseanne Montillo, and you can learn more about her work at simonandschuster.com. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on Apple and Spotify and writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org, Mondays at 4. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Be well and have a great week.